Frank Johnson caught up with a local drummer to talk about his jazz memories.
I'm Frank Johnson, and we'll be asking a lot of questions of Ron Enyard, who is a drummer, a mainstay of the Cincinnati jazz scene off and on for decades, and like I said, loads of questions. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
Let me just start with your start. I read that your parents gave you some early steering into jazz, records, going to concerts. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, yes, both my father and stepfather had records, 78s in the day, and they both were into jazz. Of course, I heard Louis Armstrong, I heard Basie and Ellington, Big Spider Beck. So that was my early environment at home. Play the 78s, and then little by little I started buying my own records. That music seemed to be in the air at the time. You would hear it in various places, dances. Of course, this is before rock and roll, so the pop music of the day would be, in many cases, not in all cases, but many cases, would be jazz of one form or another.
Now, do you remember any singular records, any specific performers or performances that got you hooked?
Well, the early Bix Spider Beck, Bix and Tram, to tell you the truth, that was a little far out from my ear as a 10, 12-year-old, and it still is today. They were very much influenced by Ravel and Debussy, so it wasn't like early Dixieland-type jazz or early jazz. It was in the late 20s, but it had a different sound, and the harmonies were more advanced by the exposure to the classical people. But the main one, a few years later, would have been Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, live at the Café Bohemia.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who come in late, we are now having a little cooking session for Blue Note, right here on the scene. We're putting the pot on in here. And we'd like for you to join in with us and have a ball. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to acquaint you with the Jazz Messengers. On the piano we have the incomparable Horace Silver. On the bass, all the way from Motor City, ladies and gentlemen, one of the youngest and finest bass players in the business today, our bassist, Doug Watkins. Doug Watkins. And on the tenor saxophone, we have a new star on the modern jazz horizon, Hank Mobley. Hank Mobley. And on the trumpet, we have a perennial favorite. It's with the prophet of modern jazz, Charlie Parker. He's our arranger now and our trumpeter. The uncrowned king, ladies and gentlemen, Kenny Dorham. Kenny Dorham. And at this time, we want to do a little thing that was recorded before some of us playing up here got into the world. Beautiful thing entitled Salt Winds.
That was life-changing for me. It just, that sound, that unity that they had, that would be the Kenny Dorham, Hank Mobley, Doug Watkins, Horace Silver band, which made two volumes of that Live at the Cafe Bohemia, and then another one on Columbia labels.
And that would have been, early, mid-50s?
Yes, mid-50s, I guess. But to this day, that's one of the strongest units. Very tight ensemble, but it wasn't, you'll understand what I'm trying to say, it wasn't a sterile tightness. A lot of times, real well-rehearsed, tight. It's almost too, I don't want to say slick, but too well-organized, and it would possibly take away from the improvisation or the sense of improvisation. But Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers had it all, had both that spontaneous and great soloist, of course.
Is there any coincidence that we're talking Art Blakey and you turn out to be a drummer?
Yes and no. Of course, you're drawn to that, and that's your role model, so to speak. But on the other hand, I listen not only as a drummer. My hookup is how the drummer hooks up with the soloist, like Max Roach and Clifford Brown, or Coltrane and Elvin Jones, or Monk and Art Blakey. Those are all those good hookups. So I think, yes, the drums, but also how the drums fit in the improvisation with other instruments. So that's two sides of the coin, I guess.
That was a recording, you said, around mid-50s, and you actually spent some time in New York not too long after that. And I'm curious if you can give us an idea of what the scene was like. I mean, this is like a mythical time for the music of jazz.
Oh, boy. I was about a year out of high school, or a year or two. I'd gone out on the road with a group with my dear friend Paul Plummer, great saxophonist who later recorded with George Russell on Riverside label. And then the road, I think we got stranded in Moline, Illinois, and some way I limped home and then went to New York with a friend. And it was an incredible period, very fertile jazz scene, especially in New York. I think I spent every evening sipping on a beer to make it last for 2 hours at the Cafe Bohemia. Village Vanguard some, Birdland some, but I was living just around in the village, just around the corner from Village Vanguard. But we would go to the Cafe Bohemia. It's hard to imagine, and I tell young musicians this, back in that day, there would be a double bill wherever, main jazz clubs, whether Blue Note in Chicago or the clubs in New York, two headliners and an intermission trio. So when we arrived at the Cafe Bohemia, it was Art Blakey and the Messengers playing opposite Zoot Sims and Al Cohn Quintet. Intermission trio, I believe, was Ron L. Bright Trio. So it just continuous music, probably, you know, from 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the morning. So, and then Zoot Sims and Al Cohn left, and Max Roach Quintet comes in playing opposite Art Blakey. If you can imagine, the two heaviest drummers on the planet. Two sets of drums on the stage. Fortunately, it was a large stage. And then later, Miles Davis comes in with Sonny Rollins in place of Coltrane. And Coltrane had just left to go to join Thelonious Monk Quartet. So this is just an incredible scene. And that's just one spoke of the wheel. There was things going on all over. I mean, I heard Dizzy's big band at Birdland. Heard Horace Silver afternoon concert up in Harlem. I forget the club. Might have been Club Baron. I'm not sure. But, yeah, it was the people's music then.
I've got to ask, too. I mean, just going back all those years, how much would an evening like that cost? How much was a cover charge to go in and see an entire night of music like that?
Well, if you were doing like the choice seats would cost some money. I guess there would be a minimum or I don't recall. And I look back on this, I wonder how the musicians were paid, and maybe they weren't paid very well. Like I say, it was a double bill and a trio, but you would get the cheaper seat, or maybe at the bar, and like I said, sip on a beer for an hour or two. You know, I'm not a big, heavy beer drinker, but I could space two beers out over 3 hours, probably, or 4 hours. But they were understanding, and the Cafe Bohemia was such a great hangout. Miles Davis would come in quite often with a camera to take pictures of Art Blakey and the quintet, the Messengers. And then sometimes Art would get on the microphone, and he could really do some talking. And he would say, come on, Miles, get up here. And Miles, I guess, maybe had his mouthpiece with him. I don't know that he'd play Bill Hardiman's mouthpiece. But he'd sit in, and you'd see Percy Heath there. You'd see all the cats would come in and hang, maybe during intermission, or maybe they weren't working that night. So getting back to the cost to go in, if you would like sit at the bar or stay out of everyone's way, you could pretty well hang for a very little amount of money. But again, I look back and I'm thinking, how did they pay two quintets and an intermission trio? So it's kind of questionable how, of course, everyone was at home living in New York. So maybe they made their money traveling. But that's an unanswered question.
Well, let's go next few years. You came back to the Midwest, Cincinnati specifically. And one of the clubs that you mentioned in an interview some years ago was here in town, was Babe Baker's Jazz Corner.
Oh, yes.
And I got to admit, I've never heard of that, but you can tell us, where was it? What kind of a place
was it?
Well,
it was on Redding Road, just a block past where the Sears building used to be. I guess that would be Martin Luther King intersection. Mm-hmm. I think it was at Union and Redding. For some reason, I remember that. But anyway, it was just north of Martin Luther King. The building is still there. I think it's still a bar. It was a small place. But Babe had jazz there a lot, a Coltrane quintet with Eric Dolphy. They played there four or five nights. Lockjaw Davis with Shirley Scott would be there. Arthur Edgehill was the drummer. They would be there for weeks at a time. Great club. Food, steak or chicken, French fries, salad, and a bar.
And how many people would come to this?
Well, it was, at that time, like I say, jazz was more people's music than it is today, unfortunately. But, yeah, and too, with names, and of course there would be a cover charge. I played there a lot, and of course with local groups there wouldn't be a cover. But when they'd have names, a reasonable cover for that period of time. But, yeah, it was well attended. And there's a little place across the street, the Cabana Lounge, that would also have jazz. I played there with Roland Kirk. Well, Roland would have sessions in the afternoon. He played all the time. I mean, he played day and night, it seems. But again, there was a certain section of people in all the cities that would relate to jazz music and knew good jazz, of course.
Well, you know, and the scene at that time was something that will probably never be replicated because we had, at the time here in town, an actual jazz station, full-time jazz station, WNOP.
Right.
And you knew some of the people there. I'm curious, you know, how did the station interact with the local jazz scene then?
Well, it would serve as the hub. I mean, the jazz people in the daytime, if you weren't playing your records, that was your station. You would be at wherever it was, 700, something, I forget where it was.
740.
740.
Right.
And, yeah, you'd drop in on a friend's house and NOP would be on. And that was the hub of activity into the living room downtown on Walnut Street. And other clubs as well. I mean, Walnut Street, we'll talk about that in a minute. But they would play the artist records, say Jack Sheldon or Betty Carter. Oscar Peterson Trio was there for a week.
Thank you.
It's just, I tell young musicians this, and they say, you've got to be kidding, man. J.J. Johnson Quartet, Bill Henderson, great singer, not very well known, but Betty Carter would be there a lot. So that would work together. That would help promote the artists that were in town. Mark Murphy used to play there a lot. So, yeah, it was the hub, and you kind of get a calendar that was happening, who's playing where. So, yeah, it was hand in glove situation. They were, of course, they were both rooted in jazz. It worked out quite well.
It's like talking with a historian and almost an encyclopedia here. Ron Enyart, mainstay of the Cincinnati jazz scene, a drummer for years, and we're talking about what the jazz scene was like in Cincinnati some 40, 50 years ago. And you talk about a lot of the clubs. Just how many active clubs were there in the area?
Well, I mentioned Walnut Street. Again, I tell young musicians this, and they can hardly conceive of such a scene because it's so different now. The audience has shifted maybe more to commercial efforts and industry rooted. But Walnut Street will start between 4th and 5th. There was the Gibson Hotel. They had a lounge there called the Gibson Girl Lounge.
Yeah, this was the Sheraton Gibson, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. A little Minute Chef restaurant was there. It was 24 hours. That would be the hang. You could go down there at 4 in the morning and maybe get a gig, see some musicians. That's where everyone would hang out. Anyway, Gibson Girl Lounge, Toshiko Akiyoshi Trio would be there. Ralph Sharon would be there. Different groups. Across the street was a place called the Caucus Room. Cal Collins would be playing there with Jack Prather. Small little place, guitar and bass. You go up the next block would be the Living Room. This is between 5th and 6th. That would be always happening. Like I said earlier, major players. Oscar Peterson Trio. DeFelice Trio was kind of the house band there. And he could sell anyone on anything. So he was good promoter for the music, dear friend, and a great trio. Frank Vincent was his pianist at the time. Anyway, that was happening. Then you go between 5th and 6th. I used to play there a lot. I played there with King Pleasure. Had my own quartet there. On up the street was a little place called The Apartment. They had a really hot organ trio in there, a duo with the singer, Sadie Birch. And I had that Dinah Washington sound. How to describe it, but we know what that is. Across the street was a penthouse, another major room in the basement of the Metropole Hotel. Oh my God, Thelonious Monk was there, Art Farmer Quartet, Basie's Big Band, on and on and on. And then there was the barn and the hangar, just two doors down. Club in the front, club in the back, alley entrance. This was all going on.
Well, let me ask you, too, about playing a drummer at the time. You said you had your own group, but I guess a lot of the time you were playing with just people coming through town.
That would be how I met King Pleasure. I was at that club I can't think of the name of, and all of a sudden he showed up. I said, my God. And, of course, I knew King Pleasure because I had his records. Of course, he did those early, what do they call it, vocalese. He put words to saxophone or instrumentalist solos, famous solos.
Goodbye. You know I hate to leave you, baby, but I'm leaving anyway. So long. You knew I'd have to leave you, baby, when you treated me this way. Don't cry. And if it's written for us, baby, maybe some old rainy day I'm gone. Perhaps you'll understand the reasons why you're driving me away. Farewell. Then maybe we can be together in the same old crazy way. Take care. And so long. Goodbye, my darling.
I knew I was wrong when I thought that you could return the same love that I have all for you, dear. But you still didn't care enough to ever try to love me. Why didn't you love me? Why didn't you ever love me? Maybe you'll understand the reasons why you're letting me go when, oh, I love you so. Gave you money, comfort too, loved you only, only you, dear. But you didn't care a thing about me. All you wanted was to have your fun without me. Oh, my darling, how could you hurt me so? Baby, when all I did was love you. Oh, what a terrible, terrible feeling. Now, baby, I'm going away. Dry your eyes and don't you cry because your tears.
But yeah, a lot of road groups coming through. And then, let's see, I played with Lee Stoller kind of during that time, joined his trio. And again, there was so much work. I remember 1967 or so, it's hard to imagine, but I worked six nights a week for the entire year. You'd play someplace for 3 or 4 months and then go right from there to another place. And I played Herbie's a lot. I played there for 9 months straight. One time and another time for 5 months. And these are six-night-a-week engagements. Matter of fact, we have a new album coming out that was recorded at Herbie's with saxophonist Bobby Miller, who is just fantastic. When this comes out, I'll be sure and get you a copy. Because Bobby Miller he died shortly after that, kind of a tragic life. But he's really one bad dude.
One of the things I wanted to ask, like I said, when you were drumming a lot with so many different people, did you have to change your style, your way of playing when you were working for one musician and working with another musician? As you went from gig to gig, was it easy for you to adapt or was it easy?
Yeah, of course, jazz is in the moment. And if you have your ears and your hands together, you know what to do in the moment. It's not like today there's more styles. Of course, you have fusion styles, but in the day, it was more pure jazz, and you could just adjust in the moment, which you still do today. But the fusion situation has changed things up a bit. But no, I think just part of being a spontaneous player, you know what to do in the moment. I say spontaneous, that may be not so obvious to the listener, but you know how to respond to your fellow musicians. Say how a drummer and a bass player get along, or the compatibility of everyone. That's the nature of jazz. To make it work, it's the compatibility is of utmost importance, obviously. And so, yeah, you adapt in the moment. So I don't mean to be vague with that, but I think you understand what I'm saying. It was, and there again, that's the nature of jazz. You can go on the bandstand with people from the four corners of the world and maybe not even speak the same language and play a concert, maybe no rehearsals, and it may be a masterpiece because we know how to respond to each other in the moment. Of course, we do have a point of reference being Charlie Parker or Bud Powell or Monk or Coltrane because we are rooted in that music.
So when you mention those people, you're more talking about their compositions, their music, and then you're playing.
Well, yes, music. Not only their compositions, but just studying their improvisation and being in the spirit of. When you play a Thelonious Monk tune, not that this is the rule, and a lot of people break the rule, and that's all right too, but when you play a Monk piece or an Ornette Coleman piece, the spirit of that is so strong. I don't want to say it dictates, but it's the spirit of it can guide you in your improvisation. If you play an Ornette Coleman piece, it'll have a little different vibe, say, than a Horace Silver piece, or maybe a standard. But that doesn't mean that you're fixed in that mode, but in the spirit of, and out of respect of. I think You could go a long ways playing those compositions, but yet in a spontaneous manner.
We've been talking about history. Let's talk about what you're doing now. Ron Enyart from the Cincinnati jazz scene. You've been working steadily all these years. What have you been up to these days?
Well, I mentioned the Bobby Miller. That'll be coming out on Cadence label, a little jazz label out of Redwood, New York, which I have maybe half a dozen recordings with them. So we're working on that. I'm playing a lot at the Blue Wisp, and that does have a new location, the new Blue Wisp. I don't know if you've been there yet, but you want to check it out. That's, 7th and Race, I believe.
I mean, it used to be in the basement on Garfield for ages.
Yeah, and then it moved over
to where a car dealership used
east,
to be.
Yeah, East 8th Street, and now it's very nice. Nice building. We'll have two rooms and kitchen. I think that's kind of a lyrics of a song. Anyway, so I play there a lot. We've been playing recently at a little club on Main Street, Japs, 12th and Main Street. Hopefully we'll be performing there some more in the very near future. So, yeah, I always say wherever good jazz is found, but it's less than it used to be, unfortunately. Well, we're trying to bring that back. And we played Caldy's on Main Street for about 8 years, about four nights a week. And that, I have to say, from an educational standpoint, I had a lot of young people would come up and say, I never got into jazz on records or CDs until I heard it live. And hearing jazz live is seeing the spontaneity of it and seeing where it's going. This is an odd comparison, maybe, but it's almost like sports, like a basketball game. You don't know what's going to happen from moment to moment. And it's almost like, oh, the bass player passes over to the saxophonist, and the saxophonist runs. But it is of that nature. We, from moment to moment, anything can influence the improvisation, the group improvisation, not just the soloist with accompaniment, but I may do something that influences what the soloist is doing. He may do something that influences what I'm doing. So, sports fans, start digging jazz. It's like a double overtime basketball game.
We've been speaking with Ron Enyart of Cincinnati Jazz for ages. Can I say ages?
Ages is all right. That's fine with me.
And thank you so very much for telling us about the scene back then. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Great. Well, I was glad to be here and discuss it.
And for Around Cincinnati, I'm Frank Johnson. Thank you.
Support comes from Affordable Language Services, a Cincinnati-based translation and interpretation company currently accepting applications for bilingual medical interpreters in all languages. You can discover more about employment opportunities online at affordablelanguageservices.com or 745-0888.
There's a tenor saxophonist coming into town to the Blue Wisp Jazz Club on Friday, March 30th. David Delegator reviews Ernie Krivda's latest CD.
I'm David Delegator. Jazz polls mimic the way fans vote for the baseball All-Star game. They're a little more than a popularity contest. And for jazz tenor saxophonists, you won't see the name Ernie Krivda anywhere on the list. I suspect he's a victim of having toiled in Cleveland for nearly 50 years. His big gig was with the Quincy Jones Band back in the early 70s. And after 3 years in New York, he went back home. Krivda's recorded more than 30 distinguished albums on Inner City, Coke, North Coast Jazz, Advent, and Cadence, among other labels. When I listen to Krivda, whom do I hear? I hear Wayne Shorter. I hear the New Orleans Reedmen Donald Harrison and Branford Marsalis, the avant-gardists David Murray and Bayard Lancaster. But what I hear the most in his phrasing and oblique arrangements is the altoist Lee Konitz. Krivda is incapable of playing uninspired solos, and his attack is consistently forceful. His most recent album, Blues for Picar, has been released on the Capri Records label. The title reflects an homage paid to Krivda's friend and fellow Clevelander, the jazz critic and underground comic writer Harvey Picar. Picar is best known for his sardonically introspective series, American Splendor, which largely reflected his life as a file clerk at the Cleveland VA hospital, his family relationships, and any number of bizarre anxieties. Although Picar could not draw a straight line, the series was brilliantly illustrated by dozens of comic artists, including Robert Crumb, Spain Rodriguez, Gary Dumm, and Frank Stack, among others. And the comic book series formed the basis for a movie of the same name, featuring Paul Giamatti as Picar. As to the album, Blues for Picar, Krivda's never sounded better. There are 5 standards and 2 original numbers. The opening tune, The End of a Love Affair, is turned into a swinging post-bop rendition with explosive up-tempo blowing by the trumpeter Dominic Farinacci. On More Than You Know, Krivda plays a lyrical, burly tenor, and the slow, bittersweet rendition brings a melancholy air to the old standard. Claude Black, the rarely recorded session piano player, is heard at his comp and best on this tune. The Sonny Rollins tune, Vals Hot, features crystal-clear phrasing from another guest trumpeter, Sean Jones, while Krivda deconstructs and reassembles this somewhat lost Rollins standard in an impassioned dialogue between the two musicians. Darn That Dream is the most straight-ahead chestnut on the album, while the Dexter Gordon piece, Fried Bananas, kicked off by drummer Ranel Gonsalves, is another hot, explosive showcase for trumpeter Jones, talking to Krivda, who propels everything into orbit with a lovely solo by pianist Claude Black. 2 Krivda compositions close the album, one for Willie, based on the chord changes from the standard Out of Nowhere, and features bassist Marion Hayden playing the melody in a duet with a band leader. The title cut, Blues for Picar, features electric blowing by trumpeter Dominic Farinacci and closes the album, leaving us wanting more. Krivda's perpetual fondness for standards in no way interferes with the superb improvisations on this album in both individual and ensemble modes. He remains a brilliant, distinctive saxophonist who's still at the top of his game. So, perhaps you've been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, visited the astounding art museum, heard the superb symphony, and are still looking for an excuse to go to Cleveland, then you would need an excuse. Well, go and see Ernie Krivda. He's there playing a number of clubs just like he has for the past 40 years. At the very least, go get his latest album, Blues for Picar. Ernie Krivda will be appearing at the Blue Wisp on Friday, March 30th at 8:30, and it's an opportunity you really shouldn't miss. For Around Cincinnati, I'm David Delegator.
Support comes from NKU's Hale U.S. Bank College of Business with a reimagined MBA program that blends the traditional curriculum into six innovative courses to prepare the 21st century business executive. You can learn more about NKU's MBA New Approach online at mba.nku.edu. Dreamers welcome.
WVXU recorded the Faux Frenchman at Christchurch Cathedral on November 29th last year. Here are five songs from that performance featuring Don Aaron on bass, Brian Lovely and George Cunningham guitars, and Paul Patterson violin.
Thank you.
That was a Beau Frenchman from a performance at Christchurch Cathedral. You'll find a playlist of this concert at WVXU.org. The Faux Frenchmen perform Wednesday evenings at Sitwell's, 324 Ludlow Avenue in Clifton.
Support comes from Fifth Street Gallery, a downtown Cincinnati cooperative of nationally recognized artists working in two- and three-dimensional media, including landscape and still-life paintings by Larry Womack and architectural interpretations by Marcia Alscher. Fifth Street Gallery, 55 West Fifth Street across from Macy's. Information at 579-9333 or at fifthstreetgallery.com.
This has been Around Cincinnati. Technical assistance from Kevin Rowinski, Rick Andrus, and Bruce Ellis. I'm producer and host Lee Hay. Next week, you'll hear about the My Nose Turns Red Theater Company, plus a visit with Ruth Dickey from the Clifton Cultural Arts Center. Next Sunday from 7 to 8 on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.